Welcome to the Patriot League's Pillar Citizen Spotlight. My name is Aaron Robertson, and I'm the president of the Patriot League. We're a nonprofit public advocacy organization that seeks the common good of society through the advancement of America's founding principles, working together to advance four pillars of moral truth: traditional marriage, parental rights, religious liberty, and the humanity of the unborn. Four pillars we believe are necessary to sustain America's ability to survive and thrive. And we're joined today by former state legislator Tim Leonard to chat about the principles. So looking forward to the conversation.
Great. Me too.
Yeah.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Sure.
So as a brief introduction, Mr. Leonard's public service included serving in the Colorado House of Representatives from 2016 to 2019. And it was during Mr. Leonard's 3 years of public service that we came to know him as a defender of the Pillar Principles, which we so appreciate you doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've invited Mr. Leonard to the spotlight today just to hear part of his story, hopefully gain some of his insights from his experience down there at the state capitol. And so with that, Mr. Leonard, we'd like to start off with, how did you come to be involved in the political world in the first place, and what were some of the events and the influences that led you to become a Colorado State Legislator?
Great. Well, thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate all the work that the Patriot League does, has done down at the Capitol, and it's been just wonderful for legislators as well as constituents to be able to rely on you. So thank you for having me here, and hope I can add something. I've been involved in politics for a long time as ideas, not the political process as much. My parents were pretty big on trying to save the world back in the day of the, you know, all the welfare battles and everything. I'm originally from Detroit, and so there's a lot of battles there. So we were active there.
Don't they make cars there in Detroit?
They do. Okay. They used to anyway.
Okay.
But it was a good fun. Everybody on our block was working for an automotive industry. But
anyway,
we after I moved out here, went to school and stayed out here, and I was married a couple years, and I was asked to be to head up the American Constitution Party in Colorado.
Okay.
And so I was a chairman of that for a few years. We rejuvenated and really brought a lot of life back to it. And the American Constitution Party is all the same principles and very Republican in a lot of economics.
Yes.
So about 2 years into that was the 1998 election for governor. And it was Roy Romer had just finished, and there were two new candidates coming in, and one of them was Catholic, and his position was, when they would ask, what's your position on abortion, he'd say, well, I was born and raised Catholic, so therefore I'm opposed to abortion, except in the case of rape, incest, and life of the mother. Well, that's not the Catholic Church's position on abortion, and so...
Would you share with us just briefly what is, in a succinct way, across the board?
It's right. There are no exceptions, because there's never an exception for life of the mother, because... to perform an abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent human being.
Okay.
That's what an abortion is. But like ectopic pregnancy, somewhere where the life of the mother is threatened by this abortion, then the doctor will remove the baby in hopes that it can live.
Right. The intent is different.
Is far different.
Yes.
It's to save both lives. And that's called the principle of double effect.
Okay. And you are part of the Catholic community. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
I am.
So sorry, I'm
no, no, you're fine, because it was a major issue, and we were at a big fundraising event in January of that year, 1998,
mm-hmm.
and my wife turned to me as we were leaving and said, mm-hmm. Do you have a candidate in the American Constitution Party yet for governor? And I said, no, I don't think so, and I don't see one on the horizon. She said, if there isn't a candidate for governor, then you need to run, because that kind of rhetoric coming from a Catholic is not doing the abortion, the pro-life movement any good at all, let alone Catholicism. And so a couple weeks later, we decided to run.
Wow.
So we ran for governor for 9 months in the year. We had two little kids. We traveled around the state. You know, it was crazy. It's like, remodeling your house. If you ever knew what you're getting into, you never would have done it. And so, we made no impact. We made a lot of enemies. We tried to bring a lot of Catholics, pro-lifers together in order to do this. So we did that, and that was it. And then about 6 years later, I put my hat in the ring for a state senate, because the Senate president was very anti-Catholic. And Archbishop Shupu at the time was really having a lot of trouble there. So I did that. And then about 3 years later, in 2009, I was asked to run for a state Senate seat that was opening up, and that's what I did. So that was we ran a year, full-time, 100%, as a Republican this time. Mm-hmm. Got a lot of support, brought a lot of people together up in the mountains, and went to bed winning by 1% and woke up in the morning losing by 1%. So it was pretty challenging for our day. And then so ever since about 6 years went by, we really removed from politics. Then I was asked to replace a candidate who had stepped down in 2016 as a U.S. as a House rep.
Yes.
And so that's what I did. And so I did it for 3 years. And enjoyed the battle.
And you were by the committee that for that role, but then you would have run for re-election.
Exactly. Right. So I was appointed by the committee in
re-election.
January, and then in November won the election for 2 years.
Right. And then you declined to run this year.
That's correct.
Which may or may not get into later, but just so we know kind of
sure,
how
that's
went.
Exactly right.
Okay. Were you done there before I go into the
yes,
next?
Yes, yes.
You good? Okay. So the question for you here is, you know, in terms of serving in the legislature, And maybe for you, knowing your background a little bit, even I know it a little bit more than what we've shared even so far, you've not run from hard work and from sacrifice and discipline, you've run to it. And what you just shared is a part of that. So serving the legislature may not actually be the most significant sacrifice you've found yourself making. But nonetheless, to run in the legislature in a campaign, I mean, you're going to open your family up to ridicule, yourself up to ridicule. You're going to work ridiculously long hours, well into the evenings. You know, you're always campaigning, whether especially in the House side, because it's only 2 year term. So you're either actively running a campaign or getting ready. So with that background, how did you bring yourself to say, okay, I'm going to be willing to do this? Because I know you didn't do it for the money.
Right. So. Right. No, you're exactly right. It is. It only pays $30,000. That's not enough. It's part time, so it's really 5 months out of the year. But it's really hard in any kind of profession, really, to be able to make all the rest of the year make sense, especially when you are campaigning.
Yes.
You are drafting bills. You are meeting with different groups, stakeholder groups, lobbyists, you know, people to be able to formulate good legislation.
Yeah.
So it is a sacrifice. And as a single father, it's even harder to be able to try and pull that together. So, but it's like war. I really compare politics to war. When you do strategic political
maneuvers
or tactics. Yeah, it's very similar, but it's very similar in the same way of no soldier ever wants to go back into the battlefield. There isn't that. It's always good to not have war, but war does exist. Yeah. And so you look at yourself as, am I more qualified, the person that's there? Am I being called to that duty to do it and that sacrifice? Mm. George Washington, you know, spent his entire time as commander-in-chief and as president saying, you know, all I want to do is get back to my orchards and my farm.
That's right.
In Virginia. I don't want to be here, but doggone it, on my watch, I will never let this go by.
Wow.
And so I'm always wanting to encourage people to be able to play a role in politics, because they will always be governed by someone, you know, making laws. And so therefore, you have to realize that those people are a lot less qualified in a lot of different ways.
In many cases.
Than we are, and we need to get out there and battle it.
And as you say, qualified, not only from just the life experience, training perspective, which I'm sure you mean as well, but even probably, I'm sure we would agree more fundamentally, they're not qualified based on their principles or lack thereof.
Yes.
It could be both, right?
Yes, yes. Especially the principles of the pillar principles, which are what I consider the most important issue that's always on the table year after year. There's always about things about money. There's always things about allocating resources. But social issues and big principles are always to be debated. That's what separates our society always.
Yes, exactly. So the pillar principles, traditional marriage, parental rights, religious liberty, and the humanity of the unborn. Is there one of those that kind of resonates with you more deeply, and that may not be the case for you, but anything that sticks out, like this is the one for me, and if so, why is that?
Well, each one of those, Aaron, absolutely resonate with me. They resonate with everybody, no matter how well formed your conscience is. Mm-hmm. People are focused on that because that affects our daily lives. Those are moral, philosophical questions that people are wrestling with. But in looking at it and wondering what makes me defend what most, parental rights is always the one that seems to come out on top. Yeah. And it has to do with, you know, when God created Adam and Eve, it was be fruitful and multiply. It was what God has put together, let no man put asunder. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's traditional marriage, right? Mm-hmm. So that don't divorce, take care of your children, be open, be fruitful, be open to life, have a culture of mm-hmm. life. Marriage should be indissoluble, should be faithful.
These are all Catholic teachings, too, by the way.
They are.
It's not just
they're
your
all.
Personal.
They're just natural truths.
Yeah, yeah.
That maybe the Catholic Church has been able to summed up, but they are, and they're created from day one. So you can't defend the unborn unless you're come from a culture of life, unless you're open to life in your marriage.
Right.
You can't defend marriage unless you know that it's between a man and a woman solely and singularly until death do them part.
Right.
And so those are the kind of things. And then, of course, religious liberty is, you know, we're here on earth to know God, love God, and serve God. In this world, be happy with him in the next. And so that is the basis of our creation. So all those other principles really go under the ability of parents to be able to raise their children to be better than they are.
Yes.
Right? They want their children to be better parents, better children, better siblings, better neighbors, better workers, better leaders, better soldiers, whatever they are, they want them to be better. And so that's why parental rights is important, to say that it's the parent that has that duty and responsibility. It's not the state that needs to replace the parent.
And to your point, I mean, what is going to be left behind after? I know sometimes it's a cliche, oh, what's your legacy you leave behind? But let's take a moment and actually think about what we're saying. You know, if this is my plant, okay, that's great, it's my plant. It's going to end up in a landfill someday.
Right.
Or any other thing that we're looking at right now. It's the human beings we leave behind, like what you're saying. So only thing that's going to live to represent us and the values, and hopefully they're going to represent God's values.
That's it. That's it. I mean, those are the legacies you'll never read. I'm in commercial real estate, so there's always a thing, you know, what do you regret on your deathbed? Well, it's not, oh, that one more deal I should have made or could have made, that anything else. It's always the love you left behind, right? The love you gave.
That's right.
And the love you left behind in order to spread. And so that's pretty important. And I hope we get back to a culture of life in America and in the world as a whole. We're fighting good and evil. So
exactly. Yeah. And it's so encouraging to have citizens like you, citizens like us to team up together. We're fully committed to that, just like
you
are. And it, you know, is it dark now? Sure, but you know, we can stand together.
Yes.
Yeah. Great. So, Mr. Leonard, we're well aware of the opposition to the pillar principles at the state capitol. We're wondering, can you give us a sense of what that opposition is like down there? Because unlike most of our viewers, you've experienced this. You've been down there.
Right.
Help us.
Well, it's wholly intimidating. In the opposition on the other side, and we can focus on, it's a battle of ideas, right? It's not against personalities, right? People come and go, people are rude or nice or friendly or whatever they are, but it's the ideas that they're fostering, and we try to in the legislature, our debates are really always supposed to be about ideas and well-formed ideas and debating those. But when I think of what the real opposition is, what the real hurdles are, it's indifference. And it's indifference with good people and people that don't have good ideas. But I think that, and one of the popes, Leo XIII, back in the turn of the century, the 19th century, really pointed that out, as it's the indifference of people toward religion as a whole, toward God as a whole, toward a creator of, you know, I'll get to heaven, I will. It's almost a non-existence of hell. Evil really doesn't exist. Everybody's going to be good. God is merciful. He forgives everything. Don't worry about it. I'm really a good person inside. Don't worry about what I do. And that isn't the justice of the world. That isn't how the world was created. I mean, in the Old Testament, we're filled with God saying, you know, you're my chosen people if you obey my commandments.
And look at Adam, right? God, like you said, he wanted a direct relationship with that man, not just drop you off on planet Earth and see you later.
Exactly right. And that's that free choice, right? The free will that we have. Love is to be returned, you know, on both sides of free will. It's not, I made you to love me. I made you to do whatever you want. I sure hope you love me as a God so that, you know, you can experience my beatific vision, that you can be with me in heaven. So that indifference is alive and well at the Capitol, because there's this huge concept of the separation of church and state. That was, you know, Thomas Jefferson's letter to church members It has nothing to do with anything else.
Right.
We need to bring our religion right into the public arena and our truths in that. It doesn't have to be, this is how you're going to worship, this is how you're going to have a relationship with your God, but it's going to be that these natural truths have to be fostered and they have to be
yes.
on the tip of our tongue in order to be able to put them into good legislation, because that's the only legislation that's going
to
work.
That's right. And like you said, we have to bring it into the public square. We have to bring it. We can't be ashamed of this, right? Decades ago, there was that phrase from the homosexual community, the idea of coming out of the closet, right?
Right.
We've all heard of the phrase, unless you're hiding under a rock somewhere. Come out of the closet. Well, frankly, we have to have that same mentality about standing up for these truths.
Right.
We cannot keep ourselves in the closet. We have to come out into society and be very proud of the truth and be
right.
considered a privilege to be able to stand for the truth. Do we not?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Aaron. And part of that is, having, fear of the Lord, and that's not in a sense of frightfulness.
Sure.
But it's enough to say that, if I deny Christ here on earth, he's going to deny me in heaven. And say, I know you not. You are given chances. You were put right in front of tough situations.
That's right.
And you denied me. You didn't do it. And so
that
boldness needs to come from a fear of my Creator is bigger than what I'm experiencing here. And I should be able to stand up for those rights. Now, I have to be well-formed. And that's part of, I think, what the Patriot League does. And you're going to get to this, hopefully, as we get to talk about it. But it's writing those position papers and educating so that legislators, as human beings, can open that up and go, that's why I knew this was right. You're telling me these moral truths.
Right.
Thank you very much. Now I can get down there in the well and make speeches and talk to people from principles, not from,
surface policy things.
Else.
Right.
You're exactly,
exactly.
right.
And the well, for those who may not know what that is the
podium
okay.
that's at the center of both the Senate and the House. And there's a lot of rules and restrictions of who can and can't speak from there and what you do. And it's there to have a civilized conversation with opponents and debate things so that there's rules around it. And so speaking from the well is always taped and recorded.
Significant, right?
Very significant.
You hold the attention of the entire chamber, either of the Colorado House or the Colorado Senate.
Yeah, I wish. I wish it was holding their attention.
Well, okay.
But at least it's
potentially holding
their attention. Yes, it's supposed to be that way.
Well, and isn't it true, though, when there's substantive issues? Now, because, of course, like you're pointing out, if they're just reading through stuff, nobody's paying attention, are they? But what I mean to say is, if there's something where there's a meaningful debate going on, isn't it true, and maybe I'm wrong, curious, if there's really substantive stuff, isn't it true that generally people are paying attention, or are you saying that people are, even then, kind of...
No, when it's substantive,
okay, so when it's substantive,
when the debate's on, and they'll know, right, because it's an issue that has to do with the four pillars,
okay.
really. I mean, look at what's going on today in 2019. About the sex education bill, that's parental rights, that's morality and sexuality. Those are really flaming people. Second Amendment rights, our Constitution is being jeopardized.
Right.
Issues of money, you don't have to be passionate about. We may differ on how resources should be
sure,
allocated.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Okay. And that should be, but the real
discussion.
Flamers are going to be when people start treading on other people's morality, and that's what we're seeing in spades today.
Yes. Well, and you mentioned the so-called sex education bill, which I hate using the anti-pillar crowd's terminology when they label things, just like they call abortion.
Right.
It's really the taking of innocent life.
That's what it
is.
Right.
But yeah, the sex ed bills that's come to be commonly known, and isn't it ridiculous, amongst so many things that are problematic with that bill, it conveys to our children that, abstinence isn't necessarily better for you than engaging in sexual activity when you're a youth.
Right.
What nutcase thinks, who has children, or even if they don't have children, just has, I'll say it, common sense, wants our children getting sexually active, and we're going to present to our children that choosing to be abstinent is not more of a better choice?
Right.
So I just want to bring that point out, and I don't know if you have other things you want to bring out, but that's ridiculous.
It is, and it's important because the overriding principle, right, which is the moral truth of it all, is sex outside of marriage.
That's right.
And so you can put sex outside, you can call it fornication, you can call it adultery, you can call it homosexual behavior.
Any of that, right.
Any of that
exactly.
is inappropriate for a society if they want to live a happy, joyful life. That those consequences of those short-term actions
consequences
are
wow.
huge.
Yes.
And so parents teaching their children that sexual activity outside of marriage is wow. inappropriate.
Why don't we hear that word that you just used? That's a profound word right there. Why don't we hear the word consequences brought up, Mr. Leonard?
Well,
why is
it's,
that?
It's most people, I think, they're just fearful of getting into a debate and defending it because they haven't put enough attention into their soul getting to heaven. And if you haven't done that, then you fly by the seat of your pants and say, you know what, I really don't know, you know, what is good and true and beautiful, so therefore I'm susceptible to others. And
okay.
without forming your own conscience that way, people, they lack the confidence
yes.
to be able to say it. And we strengthen each other by being able to help form each other and say, you know what, that's exactly, I'm going to go do that tomorrow.
Right.
And then they're emboldened to do it. And that's why I hope, well, I know that's what you do as a league. You really help a lot of the legislators say, you know, I can do this. There are people behind me. And mm-hmm. when we talk about encouraging others, that's probably my main issue. I would always encourage constituents and,
yes.
and members of the Patriot League to be able to get out there and help kindly and lovingly
yes.
educate lawmakers.
Yes, and like you're alluding to, we do work to do that. Maybe if you don't mind, share real quick with the viewers in your experience as a legislator. As you know, we facilitate these notes, and you were talking about that. So will you just give them a quick picture of what that looks like? And
absolutely. Well, the Patriot League will send out what I call position papers. Call them anything you want, but it defines the problem, and then it puts forth the Patriot League's spotlights, put forth the solution in terms of morality in the four principles. So it's not just vote for this because it's good here, good there. Most of the people will abide by it, or 62% of Americans do such and such. That's not the issue. The issue is, you know, here's God's law. Here are the natural laws that violating these laws bring consequences that are far greater than the sacrifice that we would have in the short term. And so those are very helpful that the legal do. And then along with bringing fellow members down mm-hmm. to be able to testify along those grounds.
Yeah.
It isn't effective to use language or, you know, Bible thump and to those who reject the Bible or can't stand it, or actually now we're seeing much more pushing back on the existence of God or anything else. So everything needs to be framed within
right.
natural laws that, you know, we may not like gravity because we get old and tired, but it's a fact of life that you can't
yes.
legislate around those kind of natural laws.
Right. And you heard from our legislators as well, right? Monthly you would get a note that we
yes.
facilitated that was from an actual real religious leader in the state. And like you said, we don't Bible thump because we work with anybody. And I'm sure you would agree as well. If there's somebody that doesn't pick your religious group, if they're willing to stand with us on these principles, as pillar citizens, we'll stand together. We may argue till we're blue in the face about a lot of theological issues
right.
in another context, but let's not let those differences keep us from protecting our families, our children, right. the dignity of the unborn, you know, those kind of things.
All the major religions are the same in the truth. You know, you can't foster a society mm-hmm. or procreate generations if you're not in a culture of life. And
right.
so, you know, that, and same with traditional marriage, and you know, each one of the religious liberties to be able to work together. So
right.
Every religion recognizes the natural law of the pillars.
Yeah, right. And just real quick, not to beat a dead horse, but that word you brought up, which is so profound, consequences, just wanted to mention, isn't it true that for a parent or anyone who has the responsibility to look out for someone weaker and younger than them, could be mentally weaker or physically weaker, they're younger, isn't one of the most obvious signs of love is to warn that one about the consequences of certain actions? Isn't that what love is? When you have a child, and if you love your child for crying out loud and there's a stove, the first thing that you do is you warn them of the consequence.
Yes.
Has it changed from when they're 3 or 4 years old to when they're 13 or 14 year old? Help me understand, and this is rhetorical,
yep,
of course,
yep,
how it changes when now they're teenagers. Now we're going to step back and say, well, I'm not going to warn them of consequences.
Yes.
That's not love.
No.
So
you're exactly
just
right. And the free will, as the child gets older, their free will gets stronger as they're gathering information. So you could have said easily to a 2-year-old, that's hot, you'll burn yourself.
Yes.
That doesn't take a lot of free will, but that's not a good choice in a relationship.
Yes.
To a 15 and 16-year-old. That's a harder concept to deal with. And then you have to look back at yourself. How am I setting my example?
Absolutely.
Others,
you can't challenge. Be hypocritical.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's we're all human,
so
and we all do it. But
yeah, that's a good, great point.
Yeah.
Okay, we've discussed the opposition at the state capitol to the pillar principles, and we would imagine that it took its toll on many of your like-minded peers. So with that in mind, Mr. Leonard, what do you believe to be the most impactful action that we as the pillar citizen community can take to show our support for those who are actually defending the principles?
Mm. Yeah, great question. As the league, you do some scorecards, you use position papers, you do personal support with leaders, and I would think that members following in your footsteps in the same encouragement would testify at the Capitol, would write emails,
okay,
not only of support to legislators, but also educating the opposition. It's the same letter that can be written, and I think a lot of times the opposition, it's yes or no, you battle yours, I'll battle mine, and it's just,
good point.
Oh, look at, I got 287 emails on this side and 418 on this side, I guess I need to go that way. But people who are not well-formed in the truth and aren't searching for the truth will use that as a more of my constituents that I represent have this point of view, therefore I need to follow their lead. And that's very skewed. You can do that with media. We see that with all the fake news. But what needs to be conveyed is, here's the reasons. You know, I'm a plumber. I have 4 kids, and this is the challenges that they have. And if you institute this law, you're going to give me, the plumber, more problems like this. And then they get to say, you know what, you're right. I didn't really get to see that. So
That's very good.
That conveyance of the truth.
The other side, too, so to speak, like
well,
you're saying.
Well, almost more importantly.
Okay.
That same letter that's help educating them helps me in a committee meeting where I can say, you know, we heard from the same people. I saw your name copied on this email.
Yes.
Remember when the plumber talked about that?
Wow.
And I'm bringing that up in the committee,
wow, so
and
good.
I'm very thankful for them. And they may say, well, I didn't read it, or I did, and I can get to explain it. But many times I will take emails that I see from constituents, especially if both sides are copied on the issue.
So that's significant. Even that is significant. You're saying
very
to let sort of CC, not BCC, so to speak.
No, not be never.
Let people know,
yes,
who you've sent this to.
Here's, we've got 9 committee members.
Wow.
All 9 people need to be on there. Dear committee.
Wow.
Here's why I think what I think. I bring that up, and how would you like to be the author of that? Just relaying your story about your 12-year-old child and how they're going to be impacted by this legislation. And then a legislator brings up that and says, I'm really so glad that, you know, this constituent wrote that so I can share the story. That's doing a lot of influence, and that's important.
Wow. And at the Colorado State Capitol, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but I know this has been true at least in my experience, I think a lot of our viewers think, wow, it's this mystical place. There must be fairies running around there or something. They deliver the emails or whatever. And so it's not really going to reach Representative Leonard or whoever. It's not going to really. But isn't it the reality that it actually a lot of times hits the legislator's phone a lot, depending on how they have it set up?
Yeah.
You know, obviously, out of 100 legislators, some do it differently.
Right.
But there's many a times where it's actually going to hit their phone, or definitely be printed by their aide, and they'll see that. Isn't that true?
Yeah, and without question. Now, I had an aide the first year, the second year, not the third year, and all those emails go to me, and they would do for everybody.
Okay.
They all go, and it depends how it is. And
yeah.
Some people have aides that will sort it and make them a little bit easier, but no, they're always heard. I think emails are far better than voicemails,
okay,
than calling, because we're rarely at our desk. We rarely can talk. Maybe an aide will will take it in the old days, but it's so skewed. The party that is always seeks to have money allocated that way and have a bigger state control, that party therefore has a lot of aides, and they will have a big infrastructure.
We've noticed that, yes.
And it's very significant, and that skews things, but I think conveying it in an email is always the best way to do it.
That's very good. Well, it's funny you mentioned the whole staff variance issue. There was somebody, I won't mention the political party, that had, so it was called chief of staff. And I'm thinking most legislators are lucky to have a staff.
Yes.
At the state legislature.
I got a
level.
Letter from this chief of staff once. He said, I'm chief of staff to the state legislator. And the state legislator was a freshman, brand new.
Yeah.
And I just looked at this and said, wow, you have to be kidding me. And then I noticed that this legislator was very active with emails and newsletters and everything mm-hmm. else. And this person said, I have 7 aides.
Incredible.
7. I mean, I had 0.
Right.
And this person had 7. Well, it's impossible. My high school student, a child couldn't be one because you've got to go to school during the day. A college kid is not going to school. Well, you got to make money.
Yeah.
And I think there's a huge network that's set up that actually pays these interns, these aides, substantial amounts of money coming from maybe 501c3s or other foundations,
no doubt about
whatever,
it.
And pumps them in so they can sit there for free inside the legislature, and then maybe they go to a foundation and shuffle papers and get a check for $5,000 or whatever it is, and then they come back and do it. And it's very, it's very skewed. And while that upsets a lot of us folks that are fighting, trying to make the numbers work, I always think, well, we have a big God, and that money does not going to solve that problem.
No,
but for legislatures or supporters that want to always contribute or help out a legislator in any way, that's always very welcome to do,
because
it's a tough battle out there.
Man, that is such a good picture, I think, for all of us, the picture that we just painted, getting an appreciation of kind of what it's really like down there and the variances. And Todd Bontrager, who's here in the studio with us, our vice president, and I have repeatedly made the observation that it is kind of like going down to a college campus when you go down to the state capitol these days.
Yes.
I mean, to your point, like, you know, the 7 aides or whatever. And where the money's coming from, I don't know, but we know it's coming from somewhere.
Right.
And there is not the same resources that are being put towards the good guys and the good gals. Right. So we just encourage you to support the work that we're doing, support the good legislators. It doesn't happen free of charge. There's got to be resources. So that's, we've seen that for sure. Were you done with that? Or
yes.
Good to go? Okay. So, Mr. Lind, while you were in the Colorado House of Representatives, you were involved in a number of pillar-related bills. And I recall you even sharing with us some of those when we were visiting you down at the State House. So we're curious, what bill are you most proud of? And maybe it's not just one, if you want to give us several, but could you just share with us what the bill was about, how it fared? We can kind of guess, of course, knowing the political setup down there, but how it fared, and then why do you believe it fared that way?
Sure. Aaron, twice for 2 years in a row, I ran to stop trafficking of aborted human baby parts in our state. And it was, I had seen in my first year an invoice that was University of Colorado was purchasing aborted baby human parts. And I saw it, and I was physically sick when I saw paid for by, paid Visa $336 for a female eyeball third trimester. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And so I ran it the next year, my second year. I ran it again the third year, and this time I was much more adamant to CU Boulder. Had gotten a little bit of gruff. I talked to their attorney there and said, if this passes, because it was very simple. It was, do whatever you want. Make whatever choices you want. But if you traffic in aborted baby parts, you will lose, the state of Colorado will not be able to fund you.
Right.
And so you do what you want. I wasn't telling them what they could do.
Right.
But they were not going to get taxpayer money into an institution that created demand for baby parts, right?
Gosh.
I need more eyeballs. I need more liver, skin. It was just horrible. I need more. Who out there can supply me with more of these parts? And that creates a market. Now, they're there adamant and saying, oh, well, they're donors and all that. Well, I can't donate your head. You know, I can't donate your brain. I can't donate your body parts. Why could a mother donate a child's aborted part? Anyway, it was disgusting.
Man.
And of course, it failed. But and everybody talked about, oh, well, these are for science and for good. And, you know, and you could feel the you know, forum for us to be able to talk about how dare you use other people to foster your better quality of life.
Right.
This solves problems. This is Nazi Germany.
That's
if
right.
I can just, you know, harvest from you, or we've got it going on in China all the time.
Yes.
Harvesting parts from prisoners in order to foster others. And we know we know that's immoral. Mm. And, of course, that was defeated. Party line, as usual. But I think one bill that was far more interesting is when the last of my final session, the oath of Colorado was pretty clear for ever since 1876, when we were founded. It was a very straightforward oath: is, you know, raise your right hand and do you swear to uphold by the, you know, ever living God, such and such.
Yes.
And then for people who were conscientiously against oath taking, that there would be what's called an affirmation. You could say, you know, I swear, basically it was by myself. You didn't swear, you affirmed
it, yeah,
that this was true. And that was the only two ways that you would take an oath in all of Colorado. Well, last year, the Statutory Revision Committee is charged with trying to make laws easier, faster, and consolidated. And they took that oath on in order to, because there were a lot of different entities, special districts and everyone else, that were taking different oaths. And so they consolidated to one, but doing that, they actually added a third oath. And it was, and they changed the order of it, that you could affirm, and if you chose to, you could affirm or swear by the ever-living God, or you could just swear. And I guess it was swearing by yourself.
Okay.
That you weren't swearing by anybody. Well, that changed the integrity of the law, and that was above and beyond what the Statutory Committee. I happened to see it accidentally before it went on second reading, so it went to the House floor, and I called them on it, and I said, and I told the sponsors of the Statutory Committee, I said, I'm going to speak on this bill because this overstepped the bounds, and two Democrats said, you know, you're right. our goal, whether we like it or not, whether we want it, we have no authority as this committee to be able to change this bill.
Because this was in the Constitution?
It's in the Constitution.
Yeah, right. So there is no authority.
So
interesting.
They couldn't do it. So anyway, we got it reversed and we left the House fine, just how it was, where the oath was where it was, and what I call a priority to the ever-living God. It got over to the Senate, and it got bamboozled in the Senate. We had a senator I won't name, knew what she was doing and said, we need to reverse this again. It got reversed, and they came back, and it went under my nose because I took my hands off it, and the governor signed it. And signed that it basically took God out of the oath. It removed it as a, if you choose to, you can swear by the ever-living God if you want to. But here's the other oath. You swear by yourself, you affirm by yourself, and you can always add God in. So then I ran a bill at the end. I got a late bill because I caused a ruckus, and we got it in the Senate. And Vicky Marble, who's a great pillar
person. Yes, we work with her. She's very good.
Started there. It was the absolute last bill that got
session?
Off the floor of the House.
Wow.
And we had debate on it, which I told the Speaker, I'm not here to debate it. I'm here to just correct it on air. And sure enough, some of the Democrats really wanted to debate it. We had some Catholics talking about, what do you mean ever-living God? There's gods that are dead that people can worship. It was a horrible exchange of ideas. We got to see a lot. We had a fellow who has a Master of Divinity was there, all talking about how many gods there were and how wrong this was. And And we finally got a pass on a very slim margin. So we got God put back in. It wasn't the way it was, but at least was back in the oath. And we said, who would have ever had to fight so hard? It was a clear indication of our day and age, this indifference of there is no God, there is no no truth, no supreme being. And so here we were after 1876, 142 years, we're debating whether we should be swearing by an ever-living God. So I was glad I was there at the time.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That is, and just the, for your stand on both those examples that you gave, our deep appreciation to you for doing that. It's easy to take it for granted. Oh, well, Tim's a nice guy. Mr. Leonard's a nice guy. So, you know, of course he did that. But that took courage. It took you being willing to invest yourself. So thank you very much for that. And it also makes me think of this whole idea of, you know, a godless society, or, you know, that because there are different religions, therefore we can't have any common understanding about the fact that there's transcendent truth. And I would just encourage people to consider, again, we're not taking a position on a certain religion, okay? And as a general rule, our founders didn't either, and at least the founders whose ideas prevailed in the end and were in the Constitution, the federal Constitution, didn't allow for this sort of sectarian nature, because they'd come from that. And so they didn't want to say, well, you've got to be a Baptist, a Catholic, a Muslim, or whatever it would be. So, you know, of course, we're not saying that we are advocating one particular religion. However, living in a society and being a part of an expression of humanity that completely rejects the idea of accountability to a creator. Okay? That's, and I'm not saying unity of faith here. We're all going to heaven. I'm not saying anything like that. But I'm saying a society, there is a commonality that can come from believing that there is a supreme being and that we're accountable to him. So I would encourage people to think about, okay, if we're saying, if we buy, if we drink the Kool-Aid and say, well, yeah, Mr. Leonard, that's a good thing because, yeah, like the Master of Divinity said, there's a lot of religion, so what are we going to agree on? Okay, let's just follow that line of thinking then. We get to the point where we're going to say, because there's no unity in a particular religion, now we just can't have any religion. Now we live in a society where whatever, if you and I are the two that control the strings of power in government, whatever we say goes. So if your life is determined to be not important, you're gone. That's literally, folks, what we're going to be dealing with. So let's work with those in our community as pillar citizens who are allies, who understand that. We don't have to agree on the theological nuances. There's great opportunities to discuss and debate those things in other contexts. But we're talking about civil law here, about some basic pillar principles that undergird our whole society, and we have to work together or it's going to continue to get really dark.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Aaron. We'll see this with communism. We're going to have this socialism debate that we're having now is communism. And its number one principle is there is no God. And so therefore, now it's just me and I can do whatever I want. There's no, a dignity of human life. It's all to serve a human purpose here on earth. And we've experienced it before, right, in many years of pagans and all of that. And we'll go back to that. Yeah, and so here we're going to, this debate is going to get bigger. And people need to be, their conscience needs to be formed. They need to know what they're standing for and then stand for it.
Let's take an honest look in the mirror and talk about the pillar citizen community. There are those who believe in the pillar principles, and yet they're not engaged in any meaningful way to defend and advance them. So what would you say to these friends to persuade them to become more actively involved?
I wish the day of us living a life of leisure with family and work were here. We don't know. Maybe that was in the 50s. I'm not sure. In the 20s, maybe. But maybe we have a big cycle of every 50 years, but we haven't had a war that's affected us, so there's no crises. You know, we have Afghanistan, we have a lot of things that are over there, even Vietnam and Korea were over there. It didn't affect us like World War II did when everybody had to sacrifice and they knew it was going on. And this life of leisure has brought about, you know, an enormous lapse in morality and everything else because it's given us this. And so I wish we could have that, but it's being eroded, and we're watching these floodwaters come closer and closer, and it's like anything else. If you're not standing for it today, you're going to be fighting for it extremely tomorrow. And so I would say to folks that say, I don't want to get involved, I don't want to allocate a huge amount of resources, either my time or my money, toward it, but I would do something. You don't have to get in, you don't have to run for office, you don't have to run for a board or do something, but you have to stand up and you have to say, listen, I'm not going to be in the, I think the American Revolution, I heard, was 3% of Americans, the colonialists,
I've heard something like
actually
that.
Fought in the
it's
war.
Incredible.
But many people said, you know, here's bullets, here's socks, here's food, here's whatever.
Wow.
We have to be able to hand these soldiers, these 3%, whomever they are, we have to hand them $10 or $50 and go, here, for $50, I don't have to worry about this because you've got enough ammo to be able to carry that on.
Wow.
We need to be able to do that, and people need the courage. And whether it's, you know what, I haven't done anything, I better write a letter, I better pass this along, an email, or do a Facebook. Even those Facebook posts that people watch, because politicians have their hand up in the
yes,
air, and they are watching where that wind blows. Now, we're used to standing alone. We're used to being able to say, this is what we have to do for a moral reason, because we're accountable to our Creator. So we don't care how much wind is being in the back of our sails. Mm-hmm. But it feels good to have once in a while an attaboy.
That's right.
That somebody says, you know, good job. But it's really effective to have the other side see that the wind isn't always in their sails. Mm. There is pushback, and that is important for any of our supporters to do. So whether it's give a couple of bucks or give a word of encouragement or give a moment of truth to the other party, that's going to be very effective for people.
That's very good. That's really good. And so kind of leading into that a little bit is, you know, it's easy for people to feel demoralized and almost despair. And understandably so.
Yeah.
And I think if all of us were honest, every one of us,
yes,
myself included, can feel that way.
Absolutely.
But to harken back to the colonial days, which you just referenced, I know they had a heck of a lot worse.
Yeah.
They had real guns shot at them, you know. But there is that sense of despair and hopelessness, and it's over. And so what message or perspective would you encourage our viewers to keep in mind during these challenging times? Because even if we know, okay, well, we should do it or whatever. Are we doing it? Is all hope lost? How would you encourage us that way? Or can you?
I hope so. But it's reality, right? Mm-hmm. Our battle is good versus evil. It's been on day one. That's what we get. It's a product of our free will. And so we get to make these choices, and we choose them every day. So the first thing is we have to recognize that's what our battle is. It's not the person sitting next to us or, you know, in politics. It's not the newly elected person. I'm really angry. All that anger that we're getting at a personality or a style or a group or some kind of strategy is wasted. It needs to be focused on, are we doing good and do we recognize that there's evil? And so obviously it starts with friends and family and children and those around us to be able to show them that we can relax in a sense and not be angry on that.
Wow.
But we have to recognize it. And we have to keep our framework consistent with that. Now, a lot of people say, well, you know, like pro-life, you can't use that as your number one criteria for voting for people. Well, but if you don't, you're no longer on these principles, you are no longer spreading truth. You are saying, you're being hypocritical yourself. You're saying that, well, you're going to lower taxes, so that's a good thing, and that makes the state smaller. But even though you're for abortion and you're not going to protect innocent lives, I got to weigh, you know, one or the other. Well, it is. That means you have a very small God, right? That
yes.
If you vote for somebody, when I was running for governor, and I was this, you know, the big pro-life person there, people say, yeah, I know, Tim, but you're not going to win. Yeah, but if you want me to build Cadillacs and you say, yeah, I want Cadillacs, but you're not going to buy them at the end, you're going to buy, you know, cheap cars. Well, I'm not going to build any Cadillacs. I'm not going to be, you're not going to have pro-life candidates if you can't vote for them, if you can't follow in your principle.
And isn't that same self-serving mentality, at least in principle, no different than buying eyeballs from another person to benefit your own health or whatever the case may be? Isn't it the very same essence? It may not be as extreme, but it's saying taxes, that's going to help my pocket, So that's the way we'll go. I don't see a difference, principally.
No, you're exactly right. There isn't. And God will not be mocked. So if you say, well, you know, in this case, I'm going to, you know, say I'm going to foster this kind of research because in the end, I get to benefit from it, but I don't care about the means. Right. That end justifies the means is the number one issue that's debated in the Capitol, I think, is I don't care how I got there as long as...
Wow.
Where I get to is a good thing. Well, we can always debate what a good thing is, but if you stop that and stop what the means is, and if you get to some place fraudulently lying, cheating, or stealing,
yeah,
you've created a worse sin of getting there than if you would have just stopped without that fostering of evil.
Yes.
So we have that debate a lot.
Really?
This is such
that's
a
big
good
thing down there, you're saying.
Oh, yeah. Isn't this great that our taxes are going to be lowered? Or isn't this great that X is going to happen? Yeah, but we're going to have to steal from these guys in order to get there. Well, then that end is never worth the means to justify. And so we would always have to vote for, you know, something. Well, we saw it in Build the Wall. Isn't it good that we're going to build the wall? It will do an executive order to go build it. Well, executive order... If that's not a constitutional thing, I don't know enough about that issue. You can't vote for something unconstitutional.
Right. You have to operate within your legal authority.
Period.
On whatever office.
And that's trusting that the right thing will be done if you do it well.
Wow.
And that's an important concept.
Okay. Wow. Thank you for that. Okay. So sort of shifting gears a little bit. In your experience as a legislator, what surprised you the most about the process of running and campaigning for office? I'll ask you that first, and then we're going to be curious as far as what surprised you when you're in the legislature. But actually, just the campaigning, the running for office, was there anything that stuck out that, man, this I didn't expect this? Or was it more or less what you thought it was going to be?
You know, I think it was more or less what I thought. It was, you know, campaign takes an enormous, you know, every single day of the week, this group wants, you know, can you meet and talk with us here? And you do owe it to folks to be able to listen to them, and they want to hear you convey information about what's no different than our conversation here today. They want that, and they deserve it. But the hard part is, you know, a lot of people, if you've got 77,000 people, does that mean that every 77,000 of those people has the right to have a cup of coffee with me?
You're going to get really tired.
Take my time. Yeah, and I'm not going to be a good father. I'm not going to be a good worker. I'm not going to be a good citizen legislator.
Yes.
And all that. So there's some reasonableness that says you have to be open and access, and at the same time, you have to be protective of what makes you good at what you do. People that really enjoy campaigning, I tend to think, you know, they really enjoy being around people, and that's great, but you can't balance that citizen legislator and family and churchgoer and all those things that you have to be to make yourself up without being able to allocate it. So that's why supporters help and saying, you know, let me help do that. Let me consolidate your meetings. Let's put out a newsletter. Why don't you write more? I'll do Facebook for you. Something, let's get that out and let's get a feedback coming back from folks. And that's very helpful to spread yourself out with helpers.
And that's where that support you talked about is so critical. So that you even have one aide, maybe two, because when the other side, the anti-pillar side, has all these aides, it's making them more effective in tearing down these pillars.
Right.
So, again, as supporting the good folks is just a practical way that could make a difference.
Right. Here's an encouraging thing that I think you already know, Aaron, is that if it's 7-1, and, you know, 7 people are beating up this idea, or are trying to promote this idea, and one is trying to promote this idea, if this idea that we're trying to promote is truth, and it better be, it's very easy to beat 7 people with the truth. You know, it's like if I said, let's take this room and let's patch it all up so that we have let no sunlight in here whatsoever. It would take you a long time to patch it up so that not a single drop of light got in this room. I could walk in the room, light a match, and the entire room lights up.
Hmm.
It took you hours to try to get the light out.
That's great.
It takes seconds for the light to fill up the room.
Very good.
And so for our job is really easy in that way. So we should never, ever be fearful or intimidated by the amount of money or the amount of people or the amount of energy that comes from the other side. If it's not promotion of truth, if it's a promotion of evil, we should never fear it. just because it just takes an ounce of truth to be able to destroy their arguments.
That's very encouraging.
Yeah, it really is.
That's very encouraging.
It's true.
Way to think of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. And then how about during the time that you were actually in the office? Was there anything that stuck out that you're like, man, I didn't expect this? Or again, was it pretty much, and of course your perspective is going to be different. You might, based on your background, be expecting things more accurately because of your background. But we're just curious, was there anything that maybe for someone that would consider even running for office that would be helpful to them to know? Or?
So I started in the legislature in 2016. I was 20 days late. So my predecessor stepped down. It took 11 days or whatever to be able to make the selection for me. Yeah. I was sworn in and then immediately started in, but I was already late. And so I got to observe. I didn't have orientation. I didn't know people's names or who they were, what party or the committees. I didn't know any of that, and I had to do a quick learning curve. And so people would ask me after I'd been there about a month, you know, what was the most things that you never expected? And there were two things that stuck out in my mind. The first one was I had no idea how charitable the state of Colorado was with taxpayer money. I had no idea the millions, the billions of dollars that helped poor, you know, unwed mothers, old people, young people, babies, families, blind, deaf, dumb, everyone. I had no idea. It was endless. The amount of money that was spent was far past my expectations, because I had already, in the Catholic Church, the Catholic Church does a lot, and we were always asked for more money to help the poor, to feed the hungry, to do all this. And so I always had the feeling that, you know, the government, even though it took a lot of money, didn't deposit it back. Now, it doesn't mean that it hit the person in the street, because there's huge organizations that will absorb this money. But that was one that the charity we'll call it.
Okay.
But, of course, it's welfare. Charity is when you're willfully giving it. Welfare is when it takes from one and gives to the other. But I was surprised at all of that.
Wow.
And the other was amazing to me, the racism that I saw at the Capitol on day one. It was absolutely unbelievable. Group identity politics. Everybody was in a group. You're black, you're Asian, you're white, you're male, you're female. Your income level is here. You live here. You go to this. Your kids can go to this school. You do. Everyone is groups, and I was really amazed at that, and it was blatant. It was
not even trying to hide it.
It wasn't even trying to hide it. And so the white male was so far down on the list, even 3 years ago. Now it's getting worse and worse, and all these groups, as if behavior, you know, homosexuals probably was the one. Now we're changing our words there, but was this get out of jail free card? It doesn't matter who you are, what you are, as if your behavior. And right. I thought, well, you know, I like smoking cigars. How was I to say, oh, well, I'm a cigar smoker, therefore I vote like this. I act like this. My kids are raised like this. This is my income. It has nothing to do with my behavior. I could stop or start tomorrow. And so I was really surprised and really disappointed that I thought people that had come together to discuss heady ideas had racism in back of it, or at least identities that were, we don't have enough females or people of color on these committees, or how would you know? You're not such a, you know, and I grew up in Detroit, and so, you know, I thought I knew a lot more about minorities and interactions and how civilized people get along together. And and yet it was very disparaging. So I was disappointed.
Thank you for sharing, though. Yeah. That's very interesting. It reminds me of Martin Luther King Jr., who said that his dream was the day that a man would be judged on the content of his character, not the color of his skin. And Mr. King's sentiment certainly can be applied beyond the color of our skin. It certainly includes that, and it should, and that's very important, but would also include any class that you're in.
Yes.
And so what you're sharing is that we've lost that in the Colorado State Legislature.
It's unbelievable.
We're not judging people on the content of their character, the rightness of their ideas and their policy proposals. You're in this club or this class, and it doesn't happen to be politically expedient.
Yes.
If I'm hearing you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, wow. Martin Luther King Day would come along and the speeches at church, speeches would be given for that. And the people that were making the most passionate speeches were the most racist of all.
Wow.
They were the most, that color was everything. And then the next issue was something else. And it was an amazing thing. And I thought, boy, if you just spent 5 seconds listening to yourself versus and Martin Luther King Jr., of saying, why is color here? And as a kind of a Catholic libertarian, I was always, that should have nothing to do whatsoever with the decision that we're making here. And never should, you know, in any way.
Right. So, yeah. So true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you went down to the state capitol, I'm sure you had in your mind a certain expectation or a prediction of there's going to either be nobody down there in terms of like advocacy groups that stand on these pillar principles, that what we call the pillar principles. And so maybe you were thinking, I'm not going to see anybody down there. Or maybe you were expecting, I bet you there's tons of groups down there, you know, stirring it up for these principles. We're curious, what was your experience for your expectation, and what did you actually find, specifically with respect to groups like ours that are engaged? Give us a feel for that, if you would.
I was pleasantly surprised at the work that good groups do. And these are groups that are fostering, we'll say, those four principles. And they really were a good synopsis of the American Family Alliance is one that comes to mind, that they were there. But the homeschoolers, Czech, was another one. Mm-hmm. There were some vaccine folks that just wanted some vaccine freedom, you know, let parents make a decision. So they were always promoting academically, very nicely, parental rights for those kind of groups, and some in education that were present. And obviously, the Patriot League was right there. There'd be the Catholic groups. There'd be some other Protestant groups that were right there in the same way. But I think, by far, we'll call it the homosexual community. That diversifies into a lot of different areas that end up, you know, at its own goal. And then there's still other groups that would be down there that would put a lot of pressure on. But by far, the 80-20 rule is that it's just money. The lobbyists were just all about money. How can I pay a lobbyist $100,000 to go get $1 million come my way? That's a great return on money. And so you'd find that in, especially the nonprofits, 501c3s, would say, you know, I'm trying to get by, but I would love $10 million. And so they'll go hire a lobbyist for $100,000 to go get $10 million for all these people. And you know, it may be good causes, but that's not the job of a state government, is not to fund charities. And or really any groups that aren't within the core.
We should do it, right?
That's exactly it. And if we didn't have such high taxes, and going to that and see the allocation, you know, why give to a homeless person when you know they're gonna get this for free, that for free, that for free, and that for free? It makes your will immune to that, and it makes you a more callous person. That you're not as charitable as you ought to be because it's. You know, there's the government taking care of it. And I don't mean the Sisters of Charity and all that, because the Sisters of Charity, if you see them out there, then you go, I need to give another $50 to the Sisters of Charity because they're doing the will. But if you're like, you know what, everybody's getting taken care of. They're getting, you know, free shots here and free heroin and free, then, you know, that's not for me to do. And that instills a callousness inside the human psyche that starts to make us devoid of the charity that we need to do.
Yes. And you alluded to it before that, I mean, obviously the role of government and the quantity of money that's put towards charity, good people can disagree on exactly the nature of the extent of that. But hopefully we can all agree, like with what you're saying, that first and foremost it starts from just citizens. I mean, the government is supposed to be and is made up of citizens. It's not like this independent entity. It's got to come from, and like you say, if we just hand everything over to our government, then I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, just as a warning to citizens, he said, remember that a government that's big enough to give you everything that you want is powerful enough to take away everything that you have.
Yes.
And it's so important we remember that. Oh, let's let the government do it. Let's let the government. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but there is no free lunch. Right. Somebody's paying for it.
Right.
And if you give that much power and your liberty away, that's how tyrants crop up. So be careful.
And even if it's well-intentioned. So Lyndon Johnson, right, said, I'm going to do this war on poverty, and we're going to have this. And so he did take from the rich and give to the poor. We have more welfare, more poverty today than we've ever had before. That's what I couldn't understand. I couldn't understand that we're giving billions and billions away. And why do we have so much poverty today? Mm. How can we have so much welfare? People that are dependent upon the government, the food stamps.
Breakdown of the family,
it,
right?
All I mean,
it's directly correlated.
Because their dependence is no longer on a breadwinner or working
exactly.
or employers or anything else.
Fathers are gone.
It's dependent upon the government. And so it's now I'm entitled. And generation after generation, I'm from Detroit, and I've watched it completely disintegrate because everybody was dependent. And it's like the cart, you know, you've probably seen these pictures of four, you know, the people that are pulling the cart with a few people in it, and then more people start going, the producer starts to go, forget this, I'm going to get my free ride. And pretty soon, two people are pulling 40 people.
Right.
And you can't do it. And everybody
like
goes, I quit. And so that's what we're seeing today. We've got to stop, even though the intentions are great,
sure,
but we've got to be able to stop that welfare state that we've progressed ever since the 60s.
Yes, and how do we do it? We get back to building the stability of the family,
which is
exactly what we're talking about. Traditional marriage, parental rights. We want to see strong families because there is no better plan.
That's right.
You have to have, so we need to promote marriage, traditional marriage, mom and dad, support them. Our policy should support that. Because the best welfare program is a married mom and dad. Common sense really dictates that, but they've done studies just so everybody understands that, and they've proven that as well, because everyone has to see a study, right?
And everybody knows it.
But everybody knows it.
Right.
So let's get back to advancing these, and we'll see less, and that's been proven out for the welfare of children, their exposure to dangers and harm rises exponentially, like you're talking about. And why is it so bad? I would argue, and I'm sure you would agree, it's because of the breakdown of the family.
Right.
You can't pour enough money into a society when the families are broken.
You're exactly right.
You just can't do it.
No, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great pillar.
Yeah, yeah. So for many people watching this video, getting more actively involved to advance the principle seems like an intimidating, if not a terrifying idea. And so they'd probably further feel that way if they actually thought about doing what you did, and that is running for office. And so what would you tell these viewers? They're aware, they hear the great need for folks that stand for these truths. If they feel compelled to consider it, is it, again, really that scary? Is there anything you could share with us to demystify, to make someone feel comfortable, realize, you know, you can do this?
Right. Well, the big one is, I couldn't sugarcoat it because it is, and it's challenging. It's just like, you know, telling a 20-year-old go off to war, volunteer for the Army, and get out there and do it. You can't say, well, the meals are great and the travel's great, you know, you'll learn how to work on a tank. You know, the bottom line is you got to get out there and fight the enemy. And if you're not doing it, then there's no one standing there to do it. And so it's not so much pushing somebody, it's drawing somebody and saying, you owe it to yourself, you owe it to the next generation to go log in your time. You can do a tour of duty, you know, whether you're a legislator or anything else, and say, you know what, it's time. And the time will never be right. It's like families that wait to have their kids. Well, after I have my boat, after we buy the house, after we do this, it's never right if money is your criteria. If you say, man, I'm young, let's have kids, let's go. And you just go. You don't know what you're doing anyway. So if you have a moment and the call is made, then you say, you know what, I need to be able to answer this. And however I put my foot in, and I could help out. It doesn't have to be running for office. It could be, you know what, I've got to get down to the Capitol. I've got to organize those databases for these legislators. I'm going to go research bills. I'm going to write the postcards. I'm going to put out a newsletter. Maybe somebody says, I do newsletters all the time. I'm going to ask this, you know, group of three or four legislators, how can I put out a newsletter for you? And what would you like me to say? And we'd welcome it. I had a fellow come down there and say, I'm going to videotape you every week, every Friday. And I'll, you know, you just give me 3 minutes. It'll take 10 minutes. Just give me 3 minutes of tell me what happened at the Capitol. He did it. He edited it. He sent it out.
Wow.
And it was great. And it was a really great way to educate people. So
wow.
Whatever your talents are, if you're called to be able to do it, just go do it. Don't be apprehensive.
Wow.
And it'll never line up.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Really good. Okay, so shifting gears a little bit, concerning the principle of parental rights. We know that for you, this is not a theoretical principle. something you've had to act on as a father. And we understand that you believe the government at one point actually violated your parental rights in connection with a decision that you made for your child, one that you thought was, of course, in their best interest. And so if you would tell us about that experience in standing up for your child.
Sure. I've been divorced for 7 years. So we have 6 kids, and my wife left when we had a 4-year-old to 18-year-old. And so one was getting off to college, and one hadn't been into kindergarten. And it took about 18 months from the time of the filing till the time we got the decree, and a judge will give a temporary order. And so we had homeschooled all the kids for 18 years. You know, the oldest one had never seen inside of school. Number two mm-hmm. did an online course for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Sole educational decision making went to my ex-wife, and medical education, sole education decision went to me. So it set up a conflict already on education.
Sure.
And to make matters worse, she decided to put all the kids in public school. Public school had been something that we knew was completely removed from our value system. I pleaded with her and wrote letters and wanted the kids to get out. All the kids were very much protesting it. It was a very ugly scene. That first day of school, the sheriff had to be called because the kids didn't want to go to the school.
So they were aligned with your direction or your ex-wife's?
They knew. They knew. It wasn't okay. Even mine. It was, this is how we'd raised our kids forever.
You.
We had always
got
felt
you.
Sorry for public school kids. The time they had spent, the little amount of learning that they had to go through given their day, the standing in lines, the, you know, whether it's indoctrination or they didn't get any values systems and all the things we wrestle about today, we knew. So they were very much in line. All our kids were 5 years above their grade, and we really, you know, we instilled them, their time was valuable, they're educated. Well, and my wife did all the educating, so, you know, she worked hard at that. I did all the other curriculum stuff and everything else. Anyway, she got this sole decision-making. Then she decided to put him into public school. Well, in context with the issue that I had trouble with, I had two numerous encounters with the magistrate. And one of them was that our now freshman in high school started this high school as public school, had a very tough time.
Okay.
Very tough time adjusting to the environment, the kids, the morality, or lack thereof.
I can imagine.
The academics, you name them, all the way down, and it was eating his soul. He was getting worse and worse. He and the other kids would tell about the swearing, the disregard for morality and interaction between boys and girls, and you know all this high school stuff that he was now encountering, and so his whole year got worse and worse and worse. He was very despondent, very rebellious, not just to me, but to every siblings, everyone.
It's hard to watch, right? As the
it
dad,
was hard to watch.
You're
it was hard to watch.
This.
And while, you know, we need to know this as divorced, a society that fosters divorce and fosters it because it's one-sided, that we ask the judges and the magistrates to make decisions that are based upon the best interest of the child. But remember, the court already looks and says, we already know the best interest of the child is for that father and that mother to stay married.
Yes.
And so you guys have already made the decision, not in the best interest of the child, but in your own best interest. You pick which one.
Sure.
Now, I'm not talking about the 80-20 rule of, you know, abuse and beatings and alcoholism and, you know, all that stuff. I'm not talking about that. We already know that our society in a bell curve is made up of a lot of people that go, hey, this is just too much work.
Right.
The grass is greener on the other side.
Right.
Whether you're husband or wife, they look the other way and they want out. And they make that decision for their own best interest, and those kids suffer. Now you come to the court and go make that in the best interest of the child, and they go, you've already chosen improperly. And now you expect me as a judge or a magistrate to choose it. So I give judges and magistrates a little bit of leeway in that. But the bottom line was in our thing, we had trouble. Finally, my ex-wife kicked the child out and at Christmas time came to my house and lived with me 100%, but I didn't get educational decision-making. He was very despondent, and I said, you know what? We need to go move him from this public school back to the online school that he had been for. Great Judeo-Christian, free market, constitutional. It's called Freedom Project Academy out of Wisconsin. Fabus, he did well in it the year before.
Yeah.
He went back to it, and they said he caught back up, and it was great. He spent his semester going better, but I made a decision that was a major decision outside of what her purview was, and she wanted to send back. And anyway, so when it was done, she filed a contempt of court and said that I disobeyed the court's order, that she had decision-making, and I did, and I said, nope, I made a medical decision because he was so, you know, near depressed.
Unstable.
You named the whole list. The magistrate said, that's just a list of another typical teenager. Mr. Leonard, you violated my contempt of court, and I'm going to slap you with a fine. And it was significant. It was five digits, and, you know, I had to pay attorney's fees. And in the end, I said, hey, if that's what it takes for my kid to be able to get relieved of this atmosphere, I would.
Wow.
So the next year came, next fall came, and he said, Dad, I got my act together. You know, I got it, went to public school, ended up doing real well. He had his self-esteem back. He was back, ended up being salutatorian of his class.
Wow.
Everything was great. But then, fast forward 2016, I'm appointed now to be elected official. For whatever reason, my former spouse wanted to file another contempt of court. This time it was on an issue that was now over a year old, that I had not signed a permission slip for my first grader to have an iPad in the last 6 weeks of school. The school said, we're going to give iPads, we're going to start a new program, we're going to see if these first graders, we're going to teach on an iPad. And I rolled my eyes and go, here we go again. You know, what are we going to do, flashcards? I mean, what on earth is a first grader going to do with an iPad that's connected to the internet? You know, bring it home to other kids. Who knows what they're going to look at it? You know,
yes.
There's nothing good about having a first grader have screen time on an iPad. And so I wouldn't sign the form. And so my ex...
And by the way, if someone disagrees with your conclusion, you're the father, right? And right. So even if someone was doing this saying, well, I think iPads are great or whatever, it's you're the father.
Now that's in a perfect world of a house that isn't divided,
sure,
that doesn't have the court's ruling of who's got education. So she went down to school and said, I don't give a rip what he says. You know, I have education. So here's a court order.
Okay.
I have it.
Yeah.
And the school made the decision and said, you know, we don't want to get involved in the lawsuit. We don't want one parent to say yes, the other parent to say no. So we're just going to skip it and say no. And that went on for, so what? Mm. No big deal. No, she ended up moving on to another school and skipping a grade. It had nothing to do with anything. But now that I was elected official, she brought that back into the public and said, okay, this is my contempt. We had a hearing. I had to hire an attorney. And sure enough, we're in this now. I'm a city legislator. We've got an audience with reporters in it. And this is getting exciting. And the magistrate said, and I said, well, this is an insignificant educational decision. This has nothing to do with education.
It's one of these.
That's all it is. And it doesn't, and the kids learned about it before. Well, you're not qualified. I mean, the order said you are, as the father, you are not qualified to make a decision that is significant or insignificant.
Mm.
Therefore, she's had educational decisions, so therefore you violated my court order. Didn't violate any law. You violated my court order.
Mm.
And because I gave you a fine before, you obviously don't learn about fines. I'm giving you jail time. So she sentenced me right there to 2 weeks in jail and said, you'll go from this courtroom to jail for 2 weeks. And luckily, the 2 weeks ended the day before Christmas. And my attorney was aghast. Everybody was aghast. Couldn't believe it.
My goodness, Mr.
And
Ryan.
So that was the story of
how
to go to jail, not having your child have an iPad.
But again, I think it's so profound for our viewers and for me to hear that you share your willingness to suffer. Let's not forget what he just said. You say five figures?
Yeah, for the fine.
Five figures.
It was.
And I'm sure you weren't talking about five nickels.
So
the money that you know he was willing to lose, I guess, however you want to put that, and then the shame, the stigma of being thrown in a jail. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, if I heard you correctly, you have six children.
Yes.
Right? It wasn't affecting all your children. It was affecting, at that time, just the one.
This one.
You did that for one of your children because... As parents, and this man demonstrated, true love for your child means you're going to stick up for them, defend them, no matter what the cost. And you're just a living example of that. We're so honored to have you here in the studio with us to hear that story. It's just so profound. It's moving to me. And I hope that we will all take inspiration from that. Truly.
Well, thanks. I'm no hero.
I know.
You know,
I
made the call to say, I don't want my children to have an iPad. I don't want them to be on the internet unsupervised. I don't know what they're pumping, what they're going to pump into the kids or how it's going to lead them astray. I didn't think that was a decision that was going to violate a court order. I never thought it was. I thought it was so insignificant. I wasn't, you know, moving their kids' school or telling what teachers they should have or what grade they should have or what school they should go to or anything else like that. I thought it was an absolutely insignificant decision. So the amazement is, and I got letters from tons of people saying, that's the court system I'm talking about. That's, you know, magistrate or judge that think even the interpretation of a law, when I said, well, that's not what the law says, it doesn't matter what you think, it's what I think as the judge or magistrate. And if I say that this is an educational decision, then it is. And if you found out about it a year and a half too late, then that's how you found out about it. And if I have to tell you, you know, it's the harsh punishment was, I know, was because of my Christian, conservative, constitutional values, because of how hard the opposing attorney worked at saying, look, judge, look why he didn't want them to go to public school. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to because the books are written by homosexuals, that Planned Parenthood was teaching sex education, that condoms and abortions were solutions to life, and all these things. And so that didn't sit well with the court. And so even though that was the ways we'd always raised our children, that, you know, because when I got in there and found out that, you know, here's somebody with their fifth drunk driving charge that was in there for 3 days, I knew this had nothing to do with my crime of, you know, not following a judge's order. So that's what, you know, if I had to do it all over again, would I do it? I don't know. I wish, you know, that wasn't, you know, what's ahead of me and what was behind. But it was, you know, in the end, those experiences brought my children together, brought me together. They really got to see it. They got to understand exactly what's at stake, and they got to see how valuable the importance of education was for me. And part of it was when I was in jail, Speaker of the House was asking for my removal from the Education Committee. Why would he make the education decisions for 900,000 kids when he doesn't even have the educational right for his own children?
Right.
Well, that should go the other way. Can you possibly imagine the judge could take away a decision from a father who is so engrossed in children's education that I had none?
Wow.
And that was an amazing part of it. And it resonated with a lot of people. I had a lot of letters from a lot of fathers.
Wow.
Mothers and divorced people saying, please help me with my case. How can I help you with your case? I can't even do myself.
And looking back, would you say it was worth it?
Oh, without question, it was worth it. I needed to, you know, I don't know. You know, the next day is another battle. This wasn't about so much about an iPad and a first grader as it was about, you know, a high conflict divorce, and the kids got to see that. But, you know, to have three of my older kids have to come down to the Jefferson County Jail and pick me up at 6:01 in the morning, that's pretty humbling. That's a pretty, with the newspaper reporter or the, you know, channel, whatever it was, out there doing the, you know, we want you in an orange jumpsuit and what do you have to say about all that.
Right.
And my kids got to see, you know, up front and close about how the media is and how people are, and that battle of good and evil. And they got to see that, and they got to see, they knew my side of the story, they got to see it more. But it did a lot for my, positive in a sense, for my children in that way.
Well, we appreciate you, and thanks for being willing to share this, obviously a very personal story, with our viewers, so hopefully they can benefit in some small or large way.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah. Well, I'd say, you know, don't be afraid of the consequences of your actions. You have to do what you have to do. And, you know, I didn't expect what I got. I wouldn't want it again. It wasn't, in a sense, it wouldn't be, if I knew what I was up against, it wouldn't have been positive. I maybe would have figured out something else. But either way, you know, I would always encourage everybody, do the action that you have to do. And don't worry about the consequences, because, you know, even my experience in jail was amazing one, a very amazingly positive one. And so I conveyed that to my kids. And so in the end, God has a way of being able to, you know, go in the lion's den or go in the burning furnace and, you know, not get burned and not, you know, be fearful or anything else. Yeah.
Excellent. So shifting gears a little bit there, those who recognize the humanity of the unborn, we've been fighting against the tragic U.S. Supreme Court decision, Roe v. Wade, since 1973. So during 45 years, the pro-life community has had opportunities to grow in its effectiveness. So what, in your view, makes the pro-life community most effective when championing the lives of the most innocent among us?
The most effective in the pro-life movement is a constant pushback. It's not being silent. So there's all different tactics. We could be army generals, and how do we take the hill? You can say by plane, I say by water, others say by land, you know, whatever it is, and we can always argue, we always have the goal, this is what we want our goal, the goal to be. And the goal always has to be clear that it is the permanent elimination of abortion. Obviously, legally, and then culturally, that should also go. That should be it. So anybody who wants to take small steps and end at incrementalism, and end at the small step, I promise I will give up if we just get late-term abortions made illegal. That is immoral. So that is incrementalism, but it stops. But there's nothing wrong with incrementalism if it says, if I got this today and tomorrow, I'm going to be right back out there. Getting, and everybody says that on the other side. Oh, don't give ground because that's just the camel's nose. And our response as Christians should be, you're exactly right, it is. But you need to do this for pain reasons, for the or you know, infanticide. But look how we're going the other way.
But isn't that what the homosexual movement did too? They took it by incremental, right?
So and they always knew. They always said, we're going for it. You know, we're going to do civil unions today, but we're going for legalized homosexual marriage. And they do that. And it's only our side that fools ourselves by saying, oh, well, maybe they'll stop here if we capitulate, right? But it's you know, Neville Chamberlain, maybe if I do that, but it isn't. When you're fighting evil, and I'm not talking about evil people, I'm talking about the devil inside us, right? The one that
the
says...
The ideologies and the...
This is what I want to promote. We all sin, we all make mistakes, we all do it, but it's our intent of being able to say, once I get this, I'm going for more, right? No one would ever say, well, maybe Hitler will convert the next day. And if we just give him this, he'll convert. No, they knew his intention on day one, and we have to recognize that. Because there's adamant homosexuals, homosexual behavior, and we always separate this. I want to always make sure that people clearly understand this battle of homosexuality. Whether somebody's oriented toward an opposite sex or not, that's not sinful behavior. That's not a sin. A homosexual person or a heterosexual person, those aren't sinful people. But if a heterosexual person commits fornication or they have sex outside of marriage, premarital sex, you call it whatever, that behavior then becomes sinful. That's the behavior that we don't like. No different than the other side, if a homosexual engages in homosexual behavior, that's sinful. It's always the behavior, the conduct that we're talking about. We're never talking about the person. So that has to be clear.
Good clarification.
Now, there are others that say as a homosexual, now they're activists. Now they want to promote that lifestyle as being a normal lifestyle. Well, you can't. You can't paint a red color and say, it's going to be green, and I'm going to convince you it's green, and I'm going to do whatever it is. It's not. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be an abnormal behavior or an illicit behavior, no different than the heterosexual that can't follow the same laws of nature of sexual activity outside of marriage. So we're always focused on that. Now, in our society, as we get this reframe, if we don't understand that the homosexual activist, now that's the one that wants to promote the normalcy of homosexual behavior, if we don't understand what their end game is...
The activist.
Okay. That is their, that's their political end game. It's not just marriage anymore, right? It wasn't just civil unions, not just marriage. Now it's, I'm going to tell you what cake to bake. I'm going to tell you what photography that you can have and what you can't have. And now I'm going to tell you what kind of classes to teach in school. I'm going to bring in all this. I'm going to now change the words was already changed to gay, as if gaiety or happiness or joyfulness or levity was
somehow
connected with homosexuality.
That's right.
And
exactly.
I would say, never use the word gay lifestyle. It's not a happy lifestyle.
Right.
Anyone that knows that lifestyle, it's a very depressing and dark and dreary lifestyle. So the word is homosexual. That's the word we need to use. Mm-hmm. Now it's moved this LBGT, LBGTQ,
letters.
Now it goes on forever. We don't use that language. That's just non-hetero. So we have to start using, this is non-hetero behavior that you're talking about. Non-hetero identities or anything else. Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to get caught up in, 100 different identities.
Right.
And all it is a deviation from a heterosexual and how God made man and woman to react. So I would always tell supporters and people that when you're engaged in this situation, don't use those words.
Okay.
Just use homosexual if that's what you're dealing with, or use non-heterosexual if that's what you're dealing with.
Right.
Because that's black and white, and that's what we have to be able to get. So that's one thing.
And you're correlating that with the idea of this incremental idea in that movement, and the incremental idea in the pro-life community. Correct me if I'm wrong, you're alluding to the idea, the fact, the reality that within the pro-life community, there's division, right? Can we take those incremental steps? Is that the compromise? And we believe as an organization that as long as you shared, the goal of those incremental steps is to protect the unborn life, the dignity and the humanity, then that's a good thing.
Yes.
So I heard you correctly.
You're exactly right.
Yeah.
We can talk about strategy all day long, as long as our end goal is always the same.
The end
goal
is the end zone.
Now, different people use different ways to motivate folks. Mm-hmm. But I would say to everyone, every pro-life person, don't waste your time in what strategy works best for you. If you're drawn to one, drawn to the other, you want to protest, you want to walk. I've been to every pro-life walk and protest and all that, and we've said, rosaries around Planned Parenthood. I've been, you name whichever one fits your boat. What's very important, though, is we're salt and light of the earth. That means to do nothing is to go backwards, just to be trodden on. So you have to do something, whether it's a tiny little conversation with people, whether it's talking, whether it's a letter to the editor, whether it's calling up your, but you have to push back because silence is approval. And the most that everybody wants on the other side is, I just want my opposition to be eliminated. I don't want the truth to come at me. So regardless if on my bills or that I would do these pro-life bills, I wanted lots of people. I don't care if they spent 5 minutes talking about, a very small item. But you have to show the opposition that this idea that you have of killing your next generation is morally wrong.
Wow.
It will not get you to the goal that you want. And so therefore, you must push back on it. And that's what is our job and our duty to do. So no matter what the pro-lifer must do, they must push back in any way they want.
Right. And I liked how you shared that there's different pro-life approaches that people may feel called to. Find the one that works for you.
Okay.
If you don't feel comfortable walking around an abortion clinic, then don't do that, but do something else. Okay. And another thing I would suggest for folks is let's not create a circular firing squad within the pro-life community, as unfortunately happens all too often, where someone says, well, I don't think that is that incremental step is appropriate, and now I'm going to basically become your enemy.
Right.
I think that's a mistake. People are going to feel called to do different approaches.
Yes.
And we believe that above all strategy is good, as you shared, as long as our end goal truly is to protect human life, and we're not going to stop until that's done.
That's right.
But unfortunately, we see that.
It is. And, I was a board member on Colorado Right to Life, and I got to see this transition that took place of losing your sight off the end goal and worrying all about strategy. Mm. And even the strategy can be great, but it can't be to the exclusion of others.
Wow.
And so that division, I got to see.
You've seen it.
Yeah, firsthand, and it doesn't do anybody any good.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So as we wrap up, I'd like to ask you about just some final thoughts that you may have for us as it relates to the pillar principles, but we'd be remiss again if we just didn't say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your service, both in the legislature and outside. Seriously, it's so appreciated by all of us. So any final thoughts that you want to share with us before we kind of come to a conclusion here?
Yeah, I made a couple of quick notes.
Please.
My brain isn't as what it used to be, but...
we have something else in common then.
Yeah. Yeah, the lack thereof.
Yeah.
I would say, as I've said, we have to be salt and light, that we're accountable to our Creator. And this is what makes us different than maybe some of our opponents that have to be accountable to money, or they have to be accountable to political power. And we see this in the when people are unified and over an idea that's evil is a big word, mm-hmm. but is not progressing truth or God's kingdom here on earth. It's going backwards. Mm-hmm. It's leading people astray. People are unified on that, but the way to unify them is, I gave money to your campaign. I've given it for 5 years. You vote this way or go this way, you'll have no more money. And not only will you have no more money where you won't do it, I'm going to fund your opponent. And it's that easy. It's right. It's that I'm going to move it over. And so they're paid for people. Now, they don't think they are. They think they have a say, but I'm shocked and amazed at some good people that have voted in some horrible ways, ways that they will have to be responsive to their creator, but they're not, because they're beholden to mammon. You pick which issue you want. And so that's going to be important. So then we need to go and say, well, we've got to teach our children, and we have to be able to teach others. And it's not just, you know, the faith. It's not just what is truth, but it's how to be able to stand for it and live it. And that may mean cutting some articles and people, or and showing, look at these people. They risked something. They risked something pleasurable or physical or emotional or academic. They didn't go to this school. They didn't take this job. They didn't do that, all because they stood on this principle. And if we believe we have a big God, if we believe that, you know, he can part the Red Sea at a moment's notice, then we ought not be afraid of those consequences. We ought to be able to say, you know what, I have to do what's right, and we'll let God write that last chapter.
Yes.
And that is really a very powerful thing that people can do. You know, we call it trust in the Lord. But that there will always be that time, those little incremental steps that we take, that we have to say, you know what, I can't take that. I can't have my kid take those steps. I can't do that. And we do it a lot of times in some of our lives, but we don't necessarily do it politically or even spiritually. Mm-hmm. And we have to learn that. God will never give us a temptation that's too great for us to handle.
Yes.
And we have to be able to be willing to make that step. So,
true.
I mean, I guess those are my final thoughts of don't be discouraged. Don't go looking for battles. They'll come to us. And we just have to be prepared to be able to step forward and say, I have no idea where this is leading me, but I'm going to do it because I have faith that we have a big God.
Yes. Wow. Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing with us all the things you shared with us and being our guest, giving us a lot of important things to consider and ponder.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm Aaron Robertson with the Patriot League, and I'd like to remind you that you can visit our website at thepatriotleague.org. to get connected with all that we're doing to promote families and onboard children, and we're on Facebook as well. And you may also wish to subscribe to our YouTube channel, and this way you'll get notified of our future videos. And our next spotlight is coming up soon, so stay tuned for that. And on behalf of our entire leadership team, we want to thank you for watching The Spotlight.